Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. This is the first episode of our summer 2023 special series, Read with Bruegel. In this series, we have the pleasure of hosting renowned authors who will discuss various economic policy issues based on recent insightful books. We hope that this conversation will inspire you to explore their books and offer you some food for thought during your summer break. I'm Jeremy Zettelmeyer, the director of Bruegel. And joining me today is the great Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator at the Financial Times, author of many books, and in particular, one very important recent book called The Crisis of Democratic Capitalism. Martin, welcome to The Sound of Economics.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Martin, before we get sort of into the substance of the book, can you just tell our listeners a little bit what motivated the book? When you wrote it, what made you write it?
Okay. Well, there are two answers to that. One is personal and one is about the situation I found myself in or we found ourselves in. And I think I'll start with the latter because then it will explain why the personal matters. Obviously, since the global financial crisis, which I wrote about in my last book called The Shifts and the Shocks, I have become concerned, as many people have become concerned, about whether political economy with our wider politics and society is working very well. And as I said in that book, and I'm repeating this, financial crises are not only worrying in themselves, there's a lot of evidence, huge amounts of evidence, that they pretty predictably create political problems or associated with the emergence of big political problems. And the most notable case of that, obviously, in history is the consequences of the Great Depression across the world. And that sort of led me to think, I was already very nervous. And then along came 2016, which was a big year for me, because two things happened, neither of which I'd really expected. The one was that after a rather appalling campaign of lies and fraud, with a lot of demagoguery, the British people chose to leave the European Union, which I had not expected until close to the event, and which I thought was rather shocking and potentially seriously damaging both for this country and to some extent also for wider Europe. And then more or less the same time, Donald Trump was emerging as the Republican candidate. That clearly represented a revolutionary transformation in center-right politics in the United States with a sort of figure that had really never emerged before in the US, a loudmouth, incompetent, right-wing demagogue of a pretty familiar kind from the world, but pretty damaging. And then, lo and behold, he won the presidency. So that led me to ask, well, what really is going on? Is it now already the case that the financial crisis or some other developments are fundamentally destabilizing our societies? And that led me in two directions at once, one in an internal and one external. The external one was to look at all the evidence that was then accumulating more closely than I had before on what was happening to democracy around the world. And where did the high-income advanced democracies, and surely Britain and America would have been seen as the epidemic examples of stable high-income democracies, wouldn't they? What was going on in these places? And I came across the concept of the democratic recession, which I write about. And then there was the personal aspect, which is where my preface goes, in that I am myself the child of two refugees. I refer to myself as the child of catastrophe in the simple sense that my parents would never have met if it hadn't been for the Second World War. They were refugees from Hitler. And the lesson I learned from their backgrounds and their experiences and the experiences of my wider family, which, alas, was murdered in the Holocaust, that not only could civilized societies disintegrate, but at what seemed at a certain stage really promising attempts at democracy, thinking of the Weimar Republic, could collapse completely and be replaced by something, to put it mildly, horrific. Now, I'm not suggesting in any way, I'm really not, that what is going on now is like that total disaster. Of course it isn't. but it has settled in me, it always has, a sense of the profound fragility of civilized life and the ease with which it can disintegrate. And we've seen this, you know, we saw it in the former Yugoslavia. We see it all over the world. So, and it seemed to me that maybe we were even seeing things like this beginning to happen, you know, proto-civil war conditions, a sort of authoritarianism, which we associate to some degree with forms of fascism, emerging countries like America. So that led me then to the exploration in this book to ask the question, well, what was going on? Why was it going on? And what might one be able to do about it and about how important it is? And at the end of the book, I suppose I remain convinced, perhaps for reasons I discuss in the book, even more than when I started, that this is a really important theme and that it is very, very important not to be complacent about what's going on, even in our societies.
Right. So on a personal note, on my side, and without in any way wanting to draw a parallel between, you know, the horrific crimes that were committed on your family and my own background, I have a slightly parallel story in the sense that I basically share the same concern. And indeed, with some co-authors from the Peterson Institute, I started writing a book on economic nationalism in 2017, which, alas, is not finished. It was prompted essentially by Trump's inauguration speech.
A wonderful theme. I look forward to the book.
Yes. And, you know, to some extent, there's a personal dimension there too. I mean, first, I was brought up in a generation of Germans who were taught that, you know, this was a singular catastrophe, never to be repeated. You know, at some level, I could even say that I'm the product of catastrophe, not in the sense that you are, but in the sense that my mother would never have married my father, who was 9 years younger, had it not been for the war, because her generation was essentially wiped out. So this is how they met. Okay, so let's get into the substance. So your book is based on the concept of democratic capitalism, right? It is a term, a technical term that you define and that you use. And it's based on this idea that liberal democracy and market economy complement each other. Can you perhaps explain why you think that this is true? So in what sense are liberal democracy and capitalism mutually sustaining? And is it a stable relationship conceptually or practically, or is it a fragile one?
So to summarize, I describe it as a relationship of complementary opposites. But I also insist that it is a fragile relationship, a marriage which we need, but like many marriages, as we surely know, can end up in divorce. And I fear such a divorce. So let me explain what I mean, both in the way they're complementary and the way that they're opposites. And I think none of this is particularly new. I've discovered to my surprise, though, of course, this is in very different contexts. And I'm not suggesting direct parallels, that a lot of the thinking of the great Greek Athenian philosophers about democracy and society was not so different, except when they referred to what we would call the ills of the market, they referred particularly to the idea of plutocracy, a certain sort of corrupt oligarchic rule. But actually, it is worth remembering, Athens was a commercial society, not, of course, a commercial society the way we are, but its immense prosperity was in significant part, not entirely based on that. So let's go to the points. First, there's a historical point, and I think evidence is what we should always start with. When I started looking at the literature on this in detail, I discovered there's some very serious work being done, classically American, to produce databases on democracy. How many countries at any given time have some sort of basic characteristics of a democracy? That is to say, elections play a big role in deciding who's in power. The elections involve a fairly wide suffrage, so they're not just a, you know, a tiny electorate, and the elections are reasonably fair, and the outcomes are accepted. And then on that basis, they look back over the last 220 years, roughly, and they find that back in 1800, there weren't any democracies that they can find. And of course, there were also lots of countries that were in empires. I won't go into that anymore. Basically, they were either absolute monarchies or narrow oligarchies. Even in the US, which was then in the early days of the Republic, I can't remember by heart, but my memory is that the suffrage included about 6% of all adults, and of course, no women at all, and most men also. This is a narrow oligarchy. And then over the succeeding 114 years to the First World War, the suffrages started to widen. Countries became more democratic, and the countries that became more democratic were basically the more economically prosperous ones. Northern Europe, the United States, Canada, Australia. Germany became actually more democratic, but resisted it harder. That's a famous analysis about what happened in Bismarck in Germany, which you know a lot about. I have a subtext here. I included a long time ago that Bismarck was a catastrophic genius, but that's and a complete footnote, not important for this story. But the point is, democracy spread. And it's also true, and after the First World War, there was a temporary rise in the number of democracies immediately after the war. Then there was a catastrophic interwar collapse. And then democracy was recovered after the Second World War, spread all over Europe, Japan, and so forth. And then particularly in the last years from 1990 to about 2006, it was an immense flourishing of democracy. And then we move into what Larry Diamond calls the democratic recession. So the point is, democracy was basically on the rise with big interruptions, and it rose most in the most prosperous market societies. And this is linked with the other great fact. There have never been, as far as I can see, anything we would call a democracy, which haven't had market economies of some kind. That is to say, an independent middle class, an independent economic life that is itself, to a large extent, separate from, independent from political life. It's a world in which democracy decides who governs, but the people who govern don't have absolute power over you. Because once that happens, they can't afford to lose that power, and you can't afford to lose power. So power gets monopolized. In fully socialist economies, society, power gets completely monopolized. And if it doesn't, it's a revolution. And that's crucial. So I conclude that some form of independent market economy with independent private property, independent people, particularly an independent middle class, I argue, following Aristotle, you cannot have any hope of democracy. And I think there's a theoretical reasons for this beyond these practical ones, which are very important, which is ultimately the great premise of capitalism, market capitalism, which is why I believe in it. It's ultimately an individualistic creed. It means that society's order, power in society, is not determined by what you're born to. It's not determined by inheritance. It's determined by your ability to make a success of yourself in a competitive environment. The great idea is competition. And it's quite natural, if that's the way you run an economy, to think, well, how are we going to give political power? We don't want people to continue to hold power just because their father was a duke or their father was a king. We want the people to emerge out of a competitive process selected by the people. And that's what democracy gives you. So in that sense, I think there's a core value system which are shared by the two systems. And then there are very practical ways in which capitalism supports democracy, which I've already discussed, the issue of economic independence and independent powers and the separation of the economy from politics in significant measure. But I also argue that democracy
can, and this is, I think, actually part, though I don't think they put it this way, of what
ordoliberalism was about, as I understood it, which was the idea that the great danger of capitalism, beautifully described in Raghuram Rajan's and Luigi Zingales' book about 20 years ago called Saving Capitalism from the Capitalists, is the great threat is monopolization. And this is very much, I think, in the German liberal tradition of the 20th century, as I understand it. So you need competition policy. And to have competition policy work, you need a political environment which doesn't want monopoly. And the most plausible environment in which people won't want monopoly is a democracy, not a system controlled by the oligarchy. What makes it fragile, of course, is two great dangers which are linked. One is the danger described by Plato and Aristotle, but it goes on into modern political science. If you lose the independent, sturdy, self-respecting middle class as a fundamental ballast of society, the people who feel they're independent but know that they need a trustworthy and reliable state to protect them, if you lose them and they get increasingly impoverished or insecure or angry, there is a danger, as Plato described so brilliantly, that they will choose a demagogic ruler to represent them and to represent their interests. And I would argue that's a big part of the story of what happened to Germany in the early 30s. And then the countervailing danger, which we see all over Latin America, constantly repeated, is that the oligarchy becomes a predatory plutocracy, suppresses the aspirations of society, runs society as a sort of corrupt oligarchy. And I would argue that's a pretty big part of the story of, say, Brazil. And those are the great threats. And in the moment, it seems to me, coming to the end of what I know is a very lengthy disquisition, I know you didn't want such a long answer, but it's a hell of a question. When you look around the world, it seems to me that the demagogues and the oligarchs are at it against democracy in many, many countries, even our own. And the result is an increasing fragility of the basic, crucial, and very difficult norms that make a liberal democracy work. Because liberal democracy is not, as James Madison said,
the same thing as majoritarian rule. It's a complicated web
in which the majority chooses the rulers, yes, but they're constrained by the law and therefore property rights. They're constrained by fundamental civil rights of people to engage in politics and so forth. And when those things go, you might have the simulacrum of democracy, but it's not the real thing.
Wonderful. So maybe one way of summarizing it is there are two essential features which liberal democracies and market economies have in common. One is the individualism, which is essentially that in a democracy, you express your individual preferences for social outcomes with votes. And in a market economy, you express it with what I was shocked to hear described by Paul Samuelson when I was thinking about studying economics. And I read this in his textbook, and I thought, how very American of him. He talks about dollar votes as being sort of the essence of the market economy, but clearly that's what it is. And then the second, even more important feature is that both systems essentially rely on competition in order to function, right? And I think you're completely right that the order liberals made that connection in the early 50s. And essentially, they made it for a very similar reason, before a very similar background as what you're doing now when you're writing the book. I mean, it was about reflecting on the catastrophe and trying to come up with an economic constitution, as Eucken calls it, that matches democracy of the new federal republic. And the idea was exactly that the market economy is inherently fragile. And the answer of the ordoliberals, who, by the way, were great thinkers, the only problem was they were terrible macroeconomists, right? This is why they have a bad name in much of Europe. They completely misdiagnosed the Great Depression. But as far as the micro is concerned, they were great thinkers. And so the whole point was, indeed, you need strong market-supporting institutions, or the whole thing won't work. So it was essentially preempting the Zingales Rajan point about saving capitalism from the capitalists.
I would go even further to say that their ideas indirectly played a massive role in the formation of the EEC and now the European Union, with competition central, the whole set of rules, principles, which even the French found themselves unwillingly having to adopt. And I would argue that the success of the post-war European construct, which of course also creates problems of so-called undemocratic liberalism, which comes into question of how many constraints are tolerable and when are they legitimate. But I would say the remarkable success of the post-war European project is rooted in this fundamental set of ideas, which I wholly and completely support.
And indeed, I mean, so I agree, one has to give them a ton of credit. Having said this, we need to give the Americans a little bit of credit because they came up with the original competition idea and also the link to politics in the Sherman Act.
Of course, this all starts with the great American experiment and their constant innovation, finally getting rid of slavery in the Civil War, and then the Sherman Act and the many of the features of the New Deal. I mean, up to now, until this recent, to my mind, horrifying period, we owe almost everything to the Americans, and both at the level of intellectual level and the practical level.
Absolutely, which is why what has been going on, particularly since 2016 and has not completely stopped, is so sad.
Indeed.
So let's move on to the issue of in what sense democratic capitalism is currently in crisis. So like you said, your book is to some extent a reaction to Trump and Brexit. And so the question is, could it be, if you like, an Anglo-centric overreaction? So we agree Brexit was a terrible mistake, but 7 years after the referendum, I think that democratic capitalism in the UK is alive and generally well. And as far as, you know, the Trump semi-coup and polarization in the US are concerned, they are indeed, I think, a reason to continue to worry about US democracy. But can one really argue that this is a broader phenomenon? And so you show some data in the book, particular data from the Polity4 database that shows that democracy around the world has peaked at a fairly high level in the 1990s. It has dipped a bit since then, but it is still much more prevalent than, say, in the late 1970s when we had the last trough. And so, you know, maybe one should reply to you when you talk about a crisis of democratic capitalism, the same thing that, you know, some people would say to people who say we are in a crisis of globalization, which is, look, if you look at levels, right, stocks, if you wish, we are still, you know, very nearly the most globalized society that we were. So what is all the fuss about? So in what sense do you think there is really a systemic crisis of democratic capitalism?
That's a very, very good question. And of course, it's inevitable in writing something like that, that I am trying to prevent things. If it all was over, there would be no audience and I wouldn't be publishable. So it's clear that's not where we are. But I think there are fairly good reasons to be alarmed about some of the trends. First of all, on the evidence, I don't report this, but if you wait the number of people who live under a truly free democracy by the number of people in the world, it starts to look much worse. There are a lot of very small democracies and there are some very big autocracies. And the most notable one, of course, is China. Russia has slid back and so on. The second point is, it's not just Polity4, but Freedom House, which does annual reviews, looks in much more detail on what's going on in countries across the world. And there are many other World Value Service and so forth show very considerable backsliding of core democratic practices across very large parts of the world. And this is associated with the emergence of autocratic figures ruling really very large number of significant countries. Turkey, we've recently seen. Modi in India is an increasingly worrying case. Bolsonaro was just defeated, but he's not gone away, and it was 50-50. I mean, these are hugely important countries. We're seeing some fairly notable examples of backsliding in Central Eastern Europe, Hungary, Poland, Slovakia looks pretty bad. There's some pretty dangerous things going on in the Czech Republic. And then coming to the, I don't even want to mention Russia, that's so obvious. There's obviously the push coming from China in certain respects. But there are two other things I would emphasize. Three. One, in the World Value Survey suggests a very significant decline in confidence in democracy and democratic institutions in our societies. And that's notably generational. There is a tendency for the younger generation to be more skeptical about pretty fundamental democratic norms, free speech, elections than the people who came of age during or after the Second World War. So that's an important longer-term worry.
You mentioned a rather shocking number, which is that for those born in the 1980s, The proportion of people who believed it was essential to live in a democracy is less than 50% among Europeans, close to 45%, and down to a truly shocking 30% among Americans.
Yeah, that was pretty worrying to me. So the final point I make in this is, if we look around our countries, I mean, obviously America is in a special case, particularly if Trump becomes the presidential candidate and is reelected. But it is widely expected by my French friends, I'm not saying it will happen, that the next president of France could be Marine Le Pen, who is a fervent economic nationalist, and her political origins are profoundly anti-democratic. Now, what she would do in practice, I have no idea, but France is a pretty important country in Europe. Italy, though so far this has gone much better than I feared, nonetheless, a very strongly xenophobic force has come into the office of prime minister. She seems to be behaving pretty well so far, but how would she behave in a real crisis? I must say I'm very suspicious. And there are very powerful supporters of Putin in Italy. In Germany, even though, of course, I basically have more confidence in Germany than any other large country, from time to time, when there's a lot of protests against government, the AfD does quite well. Germany is an extraordinarily stable and prosperous country. What would happen if something went really wrong economically? So the point I'm making is anti-democratic forces, people with no history of or commitment to democracy in America, and some of them, I mean, there are a lot of them in the Republican Party, are clearly ambiguously pro-Putin. These people around. And I would add the point that Anne Applebaum makes, which actually comes more from her podcast with me, which will be out very soon, than from my book, which is that the autocrats are constantly pushing on this. There's a lot of propaganda circulating around. So all I would say is, yes, of course it's not over. Of course it's not the 20s or 30s. But it will be very unwise to take for granted that it's all going to be well. And we should be concerned about it.
I think that indeed, you know, prospectively, it looks really scary, right? I mean, first there's the possible return of Donald Trump. Then there is the potential for magnification of deception and malign influence through AI, which is hugely dangerous. And then indeed, we are in a phase of great structural transformation, which may go against traditional industrialized countries like Germany. And so it may push Germany from its current situation to one that more closely resembles the US, right? Imagine Germany loses its car industry, for example. I hope it won't, but there is that.
And that fits with my earlier remarks of what's happened in the past, because I think that one of the roots of our problem in France, Britain, and the US, which is not so obvious in Germany, is deindustrialization was so badly handled and massively disrupted.
Right. So this gets us to the main point, which namely the causes. So could I ask you to summarize your diagnosis as succinctly as possible? And I know this is going to be hard because these are three chapters in your book, and we will get into individual arguments, but give us the overview.
So broadly speaking, my economic analysis is divided into what has happened and why it's happened. And what has happened, I argue, is in many countries, notably in the US and UK, the hollowing out of a significant part of what was the stable middle class, and both as a social and economic phenomenon, which had with it quite powerful regional consequences. And this is most obviously indicated by the universal phenomenon and very big phenomenon of deindustrialization, and with which led the disappearance not only of the industrial working class, which was an essential part of the stability of our societies, but with them also the institutions that supported moderate left politics, which were basically the trade unions. And I hadn't really thought before, but I think I came to the view that was actually a very big deal in the UK and the US, and something Germany's preserved, incidentally. This is associated also, second point, overall productivity growth has been pretty slow over the last 30, 40 years, by comparison with what many societies enjoyed in the 50s, 60s, even Britain, never mind Germany or France or anywhere like this. And that the combination of the hollowing out of the middle with that has meant that for, again, a very large part of the population, far from all, there have been relatively, really modest growth in real household disposable incomes. And in some societies, this is associated with large increases in inequality in household income distribution. Actually, it happens to be the case that the US and UK are the most powerfully affected by this because the countervailing policies were relatively ineffective. And then finally, I argue that this long period of dissatisfaction was, as it were, culminated by the wider shock associated with the global financial crisis, which had two consequences, which are very important, both economically. One, it led immediately to a big economic crisis in many countries, huge unemployment, and so forth. Second, our perhaps the Creed Club, it made it clear that the people in charge of the system were incompetent. There's nothing so dramatic revealing the incompetence of the people you trust society as a financial crisis because it's so visible. And finally, worse, when as soon as this happened, all the resources of the state, in my view, rightly, but very visibly, were used to save the bankers and the banks. And I think this discredited what you might call traditional conservatism in many societies, and particularly the traditional center-right, the sort of traditional Republican and the traditional British conservative. And people were looking for something different. And that something different was a demagogue and demagogic forces. Behind all this, I argue, were natural changes in the structure of the economy driven by technological change, which, as you rightly say, is accelerating. So that's not the big time. It may now affect the white-collar workers as dramatically as the blue-collar workers. Natural forces of globalization, secondary issues, but still very powerful natural forces, which I don't believe we could have ever prevented. Ultimately, China was going to develop, and it was going to take away our markets, even if we didn't open our markets. And I argue, very much following some other researchers, basically, that in addition to that, we allowed the emergence of rent extraction practices by the new liberated rentier capitalist class, very similar to the sorts of problems that people had been noticing in America in the late 19th century. And we basically, we forgot what Ordo School said, that competition matters. And that was particularly true in America. These things explain what happened, and this created a general malaise of loss of confidence in society. Then in addition to all this, of course, there are huge cultural changes going on, often associated with, again, with attacking some of the people who felt they were being weak, being weakened by these processes. They felt that they cultural insecurity as well as economic insecurity, a very lethal combination. And the cultural insecurity was multiplied and explains why they went to the right by the fact that most of the people generating the transformation in culture and values and norms were associated, of course, with the progressive left. And that led us to where we are.
Right. So maybe one way of putting it is that we have an interaction effect of sorts. So on the one hand, we have the discrediting of elites in advanced countries that results both from the global financial crisis and the development of what in the book you call the rentier state. So increasing inequality, a sense that society is unfair. And on the other hand, we have the secular decline of industrial jobs in advanced countries. And here, I think your message is that this secular decline is not primarily caused by China, right? It is secular. And so it is driven partly by productivity growth. So you simply need less workers in these industries. But it is also to some extent driven by globalization in trade, in the sense that other countries, emerging markets, develop a comparative advantage in performing some of these jobs. But that is the course of history, right? So this is, in a sense, other countries taking their turn. And the unfortunate consequence, if you like, is that this process was accelerated and made particularly visible by China's entry into the WTO, and, you know, comes with a bad flavor because some of the Chinese competitiveness in these areas, in addition to being a phenomenon that arises naturally as China develops and learns how to build things, was reinforced by unfair state practices, subsidies, and so forth. But the point is, this secular decline is not mainly about China and would have happened anyway, right?
Yeah, I think the evidence is very consistent with this. Even if you take the biggest estimates of the China shock, it's very difficult to argue that the dominant part of what has happened is due to trade. And of course, there are countries which have opened to trade, like Germany, which have clearly and unambiguously prospered from it. So it's difficult to argue the US, less industrialized for the first place, was necessarily uniquely damaged by opening to China when other countries managed it much better. It looked like a domestic policy failure more. And I think it's crucial in my argument. I'm not blaming a few elite on for everything. These structural changes were ultimately ineluctable, particularly the deindustrialization. We have the fastest productivity growth has consistently been in manufacturing. The growth in demand for manufacturers in rich countries is not very dynamic. As I like to say, everybody has already two car, one car, one washing machine, one rich refrigerator, go on. I can go through everything. All the big manufactured stuff we have, we're just in a replacement cycle. In that, we don't have rapid population growth.
We don't have rapid creation of new families.
So, of course, these activities have become diminishing. Germany's got out of this to some extent by creating this immense export surplus, which, as you rightly note, is now to some degree threatened. And those countries that didn't generate that surplus, like Britain and France and America, have obviously suffered badly. But nothing could have been done to stop this. Something could have been done to manage it, but nothing could have been done to stop it.
Yeah, indeed. So just to make it very clear to listeners, so when we talk about deindustrialization, there are two ways to define it. One is in terms of value added, so as a share of value added in GDP. That certainly has declined for the reasons that Martin just summarized. But on top of that, you have productivity growth, which means is that that given value added can be produced with fewer people and more robots, and that accelerates it even more and then produces some of these social and political difficulties. Now, before we sort of completely accept the story and move on, namely to the solutions, I just wanted to explore with you one sort of open question, which is that it is my perception that the crisis of democratic capitalism is not only a crisis that is going on in advanced countries, it may be mainly in advanced countries, but we do have seen authoritarian tendencies and sort of an increasing popularity, perhaps, I'm not sure, of the Chinese model in emerging and developing countries. So to take the example of India, in the book, you stop short of calling India authoritarian capitalism. I don't think you do that, but you do sort of flag it as a system that is in danger of moving there. And this is a very old democracy and one that arguably sits on the opposite end of the decline of advanced countries that you have just described, right? They are the beneficiaries of those jobs. They have been growing super fast. So it does seem to me that your story seems to be an advanced country story that would fail to explain a phenomenon like authoritarianism becoming more popular in places like India. How would you react to that?
I think that's a very good and important question. And my book mostly focuses on us, as it were, because I think this is where I'm most engaged. And I think it's partly a special story because I thought our systems were the most consolidated, particularly in Britain and America. I discussed this earlier. I'd make two points. First of all, I think that what's emerging in developing countries across the world is really quite distinct from the Chinese system. And I think the Chinese system's roots in communism create something quite distinct. I call it bureaucratic autocratic capitalism in the sense that it's a fully institutionalized party state. And that goes back to Leninism. But in the Chinese case, it also goes back to this immensely long Mandarin tradition. I mean, the Chinese created institutionalized, bureaucratic, centralized rule, so far as they could centralize such a vast empire, before anybody else. And so I think it fits, but it's not what's happening elsewhere. What's happening elsewhere is more demagogic autocracy. It's, you've got a democracy, the demagogue emerges and seizes power and then hollows out the institutional constraints on his behavior. He embodies the tyranny of the majority, uses the legal system against opposition politics, against private business that will not do what he wants them to do. He will use the power of the state to favor his cronies. So crony capitalism becomes norm. It's not so different from what we see in Hungary, actually. Now, I think of this as the outcrop of a society which doesn't yet actually have fully consolidated democracy, even though it has relatively fast growth. Because to have fully consolidated democracy, I think you do need to create this dominant middle class element in society. The democracy in Turkey constantly collapsed. You know, every 10 years there was a coup. In Brazil, it's only recently moved out of military dictatorship, really recently. We know the history of Argentina. The number of really stable, consolidated democracies in the emerging world is tiny. And I think it's because the social structure doesn't support it. There's a huge number of people who are illiterate or near illiterate. There are a huge number of people in extremely precarious livings. And even in India, that really, as a proportion of the population, hasn't declined very much. There's very little growth of employment in the formal sector, and there are people whose lives are both socially and economically extremely insecure. And I regard such democracies as fundamentally fragile. And the once, in taking the Indian case, which I know best, the people who'd taken the country into independence with the enormous authority they had, Nehru to some extent still passed on to his daughter, when they passed, politics became increasingly demagogic across the country, and the political leadership increasingly lost authority. It didn't have the sort of authority Nehru had, who's embodied in him as the, you know, the avatar of Gandhi in the independence movement. So what Modi did is come along and say, and this is a constant theme, I am the true embodiment of the nation and its will to succeed and prosper. Above all, I represent the people who really matter, the Hindus. Nobody else matters. Anyone who's Hindu, who feels in the least insecure or slighted, can blame it on Muslims. And in this case, it's a
very large part of the appeal at an ideological level. The Gandhi Congress-led party is just a dynastic
bunch of crooks. Trust in me, give me all of my power. And he's a great demagogue, by the way, really great demagogue, great speaker. And give me all the power. And I don't find it the least surprising, given the level of insecurity and poverty and illiteracy in this society, that a vast number of people will say, go, let's go for it. And I think that is different from what is happening in societies which had the social, intellectual, and economic basis to create and sustain viable democracies over a century or more. But this is how I would explain what's going on. I think I could tell a similar story for all the other countries where this is happening. But it isn't China, and I think they have a terrible problem, but for different reasons, the Chinese have it too, in running their economy successfully. In the end, I think our combination of democracy with capitalism is, if we're sensible, the best.
Right. So completely agreed on the India and so forth story. This only remaining doubt I have is that if we were able to document a pickup of what you call demagogic authoritarian capitalism in countries that have those structural characteristics, so they're not yet fully formed, the middle class is not fully there, it would be slightly puzzling why we have this pickup now when those structural conditions have been in place for some time. Right. So that is the only question I think you have not answered. But having said that, I don't even know if there is a pickup or whether maybe just the Modi phenomenon has us all.
I think in most of these cases, I would say quite simply, let's take two of them. In Turkey, it was they shifted then because of the massive financial crisis of the early 2000s. And that discredited all the secular politicians and left an opening for Erdogan. And the crucial thing in the Indian case is there never emerged a completely viable secular opposition to Congress. So once Congress was discredited, the BJP, with its roots in Hindu nationalism, was the only thing that was left standing as a national party. So they wanted somebody else. That's what they had to choose. And there are very deep reasons in Indian post-war history and before why there was no other party. Essentially, it was because all the other opposition parties, roughly speaking, were regional. They were language-based. And this comes down to the uniquely fragmented nature of India. The only national movements were the great secular movement of Congress around independence and the Hindu nationalists. They're the only national movements. So if you have a two-party system,
at some point, the Hindu nationalists are going to get into power.
Let's move to the solution. So could I ask you to do the same Herculean thing you managed to do on describing the causes before, namely just succinctly summarize, if not the individual solutions, the basic strategy that you're proposing?
Okay.
Anyway, I have to say that my solutions are worse than my analysis. I like most people.
Because the solutions are very difficult to find. Very broadly speaking, the solutions fall into two categories, economic and political, but there's one overarching philosophy, which is unambiguously stated, which is, I'm not a revolutionary. I don't believe in revolutions. I think history has been very unkind to revolutions. And certainly the sort of transformative socialist revolutions we've seen in the past, and equally unkind to a continuation of what's going on now. Right-wing nationalism is a corrosive idea. I think we will agree on this completely. So the progress must come from within the liberal democratic tradition, broadly defined. And this is what goes back to I have two intellectual heroes in this regard, the great Whig Edmund Burke and Karl Popper, who was very much in the liberal tradition, wrote The Open Society and Its Enemies, one of the great books, I think, of liberalism, but never bought into the Austrian stroke Hayekian view of the perfection of the liberal market economy, which was never be touched. He recommended piecemeal social engineering. So I basically talk about a lot of ideas for piecemeal social engineering to improve social mobility, to tackle regional problems, to widen educational opportunities, to improve people's security, to make intelligent, forward-looking industrial policy which supports growth and development and innovation in societies, deals with some of the big problems with climate. I regard them as ameliorationist. It will involve somewhat greater redistribution in the countries with low distribution, like Britain and America. We'll have to pay some more tax. I think we can live with that. The continental Europeans have shown that it's perfectly possible to have a thriving market economy with a more active state. Countries like Denmark are a model, and on a good day, so is Germany and the Netherlands. And I think they, by and large, look solider than we do. So I think we can learn a lot from them. Obviously, things like health insurance and so forth are pretty important. And these are all things that generate insecurity. I argue, in addition, that immigration is inevitably a fundamentally polarizing political issue, particularly for the middle and lower classes. It's important to have it, but it must be credibly under control, because citizenship is for these people quite particularly valuable, and sharing it with other people is potentially quite particularly disabling. To put it bluntly, for the upper classes, more immigrants means more servants of various kinds. But there are victims of that. And we were very insouciant in this. And I think similarly in cultural changes, what I call the Brahmin left, following Thomas Piketty of all people, needs to be curbed to some degree, because completely despising the core value norms of ordinary people in the way that, for instance, Hillary Clinton did with her famous remark about the deplorables is politically very, very unwise. And then I talk about some political reforms as well, which my make politics more open. I think it's very, very important in America to reduce the power of money in politics, which is overwhelming, which makes politics seem very corrupt. That means I think there should be public funding parties, and I have a few other ideas. But basically, it's a strategy with a host of ideas, which I hope sensible political forces, and that some of this is beginning to happen in Britain. I've been encouraged with the Labour Party now. And I think some of it, what Biden is doing is right, though I think the industrial policies are also very concerning, that we are not going to go back to the uber-liberalism, if you like that, you know, of the 1980s and 90s, but a more intelligent version of what was done in reforming our systems in the 50s might help a great deal, and it certainly needs to be tried. So quickly, that summarizes what I say.
That was wonderful. So I have two objections I want you to address quickly, and then I have a final question and we're done. So the two objections are the following. They're both related to, I guess, the concept of piecemeal social engineering. So one might argue that the framework that you use, your organizing framework, which for the benefit of our listeners is taken from a beautiful speech, 1941 speech by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which essentially sets out a number of policy objectives: rising, widely shared, sustainable standard of living, good jobs for those who can work, equality of opportunities, security for those who need it, and ending special privileges for the few. So this framework has been around for a very long time. And I did some work looking at party platforms for this Economic Nationalism book. And what struck me is that there is no clearer formulation of that framework in what I have read, restatement of your framework, than in Labour Party manifestos in the early 2000s. So essentially in the heyday of the Blair era. And that didn't work. I mean, it led into the global financial crisis, which you argue is sort of the main reason. So what did they miss? And why should adherence to the same framework help? And then, you know, the second objection is, in a sense, the nitty-grittiness of your policy prescription, which, you know, as a former IMF economist, I really appreciate. It does feel a little bit like a superbly written IMF staff report. And so in a sense, it feels a little bit in tension with the enormity of what we're trying to achieve. So go back to the previous time that we tried the same thing. So this was essentially resetting the European economy after the catastrophe of the 1930s. And it was done, you know, with these big innovations. Let's create a welfare state. Let's create institutions that commit countries to international cooperation. Let's get serious about competition inside countries. And here we are with arguably a similarly existential problem. And all you do is sort of to restate the same basic solutions, but they then say, well, we need sort of better policies to achieve them. So maybe I'm pushing you sort of back, and I would like a little more revolution, less evolution from you. Can you respond to that?
Well, on the first one, I think the big thing that the Blair government missed, and the biggest mistake, was they didn't understand, but nobody did, is how weak the fundamentals of our economy were. So when the financial crisis, I went back and read a column I wrote in 2009. Which was a shock column, which basically said what's happened is that the British economy became a monocrop economy and our monocrop just failed. And we didn't understand that. And I didn't fully understand it. And the crucial thing is they missed all the economic development and industrial policy, quote unquote, economic policy side of what was needed, because they assumed that the Thatcher revolution had created a completely viable economy. I think the same is not entirely untrue elsewhere. So the question of economic development, which I have, it's part, a big part of what I write, is very, very important. And it's why I wrote quite a bit about it. And it's a very important part. Without a fundamentally viable, vigorous economy, which generates good jobs and so forth, we're in terrible trouble. And the problem is, to the extent we have a vigorous economy, it doesn't generate good jobs. And to the extent we generate jobs, it's not in places where there's a vigorous economy, or they're not good jobs. So this is this core difficulty. I think it's very difficult to do this, but we've got to try. And my reaction to the second and bigger one is we can only do what we did then once. we forgot about it in certain ways, and we forgot about updating it in important ways. So I do think we have to look back at these issues and say, how will we do the same things now? And how will it fit, of course, with this great need for a more vigorous economy? I do discuss land taxations. I do discuss inheritance tax. I think these are important. Maybe I should have been stronger on distribution, but I always felt that there are quite significant downsides to attempting massive redistribution. And anyway, it's not politically going to happen. So my answer is, actually, I think the idea is more radical than you suppose. But I also think, and here I think what you say is very credible, is that part of the problem we have is that compared, in some sense, in the 1950s, it was pretty obvious what we needed to do. Run a full employment economy, really crucial. Run a stable, open economy, and provide a really well-developed, well-functioning welfare state. And if you do this and you get reasonable growth, this is going to work. Unfortunately, for a whole host of reasons, which I discuss and depress me as much as they probably depress you, all this is pretty hard now. And I don't have magic wands. And I've read an awful lot of literature on this stuff. And I personally don't believe anyone else has a magic wand either, including very much Thomas Piketty.
Absolutely. So my final question is on where you see that some of the ideas of your book are reflected in policymaking and where this is not the case. And particularly, I have in mind the fact that several governments around the world, but particularly the Biden administration, shares large parts of your diagnosis, I think, is concerned with the same problem. And, you know, arguably has been doing good things to address them, which partly overlap with your recommendations. But in one point, they diverge very strongly from what you are arguing. And that is with respect to the protectionism of some of their policies and to the fact that they have continued to undermine at least one international institution that is supposed to keep the rules, and that is the WTO. Now, from the perspective of the Biden administration, though, there is a certain intellectual logic to it, which in a sense is validated by your book, because to the extent that the problem in advanced countries like the US relates to the loss of industrial jobs, is it not reasonable to conclude, like the Biden administration appears to have done, that protecting these jobs through subsidies, tariffs, and domestic content requirements is actually part of the solution? So what would you answer to governments around the world that are reading your diagnosis and saying, Martin Wolf is saying this was partly caused by the decline in industrial employment. Let's do everything to recoup that and keep it high.
Okay. I finished this book before all this program really developed, and I have written around it. And the honest truth is I am in two minds. So one mind says this is an overwhelming political challenge. Even if this is second best policy, since first best policy is not available, that which would be clearly be a combination of temporary transfers and successful pro-development in line with comparative advantage policy in an open world economy. If the first base is not available, this is a rational second best. And given the politics of America, a big politics vis-a-vis China, there's a political headwind for this. This is feasible, while the alternatives are not feasible because they would all involve more tax, more intervention, and more openness and continued openness with China. So as a second best, this is the best you can get. So that's the argument for it. And I've indicated that in columns I've written. And the argument against it is it's going to make the world worse. It's going to make relations with emerging developing countries, particularly China, worse. And my guess is most of this industrial policy will turn out not to work in the sense that it will generate actually very few jobs. And the jobs that will be generated at enormous and inordinate cost. And when I look back at actually literature produced, I did a column on this, which you might have seen, by the Peterson Institute on what industrial policy actually works. And they look back at the history of American intervention, of which there's been a lot. the thing that comes out is unambiguously the one thing that really worked was DARPA, and which says to me, well, in the US, frontier economy with a superb technology industry, you've got to build on that because that's what you've got. Putting back together again, people assembling televisions or making clothes, but this is just not going to generate anything. Even if you get the factories back, they're not going to employ anybody because they're all going to be done by robots. So I feel, yes, it's a second best politically. Clearly not first best. No economist would think that, even looking at the evidence. But I fear that when our successors, 5-10 years from now, well, you'll still be around, but I will retire, but they will be looking at this data. They will say, nice try, but no cigar.
Thank you so much, Martin. That was terrific. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to The Sound of Economics. You can read all our analysis on our website. And of course, you can find Martin's book everywhere. So thank you again for joining. Until next time, bye-bye.